Well, greetings. It's November 3rd, 2012. This is the Tribal Theocrat Live Show, a show that deals with issues concerning our people and our faith. I'm Christian Gray, and I thank you for tuning in tonight. You can participate in the chat either at tribaltheocrat.com, just under the audio player, or on our Tribal Theocrat Live page from Ustream. Before we get to our guest, a few things. We're having a special mid-month show this month on November 17th. We typically just go the first Saturday of each month, but we're mixing it up a little bit. Our guest on that show will be Roberta Lee Swagger, and she'll be discussing Marxism and homeschooling. As you know, I'm no fan of government schools, but there's also room within homeschooling and certain trends to criticize them as well. And so Roberta will come on and lay it all out for you on November 17th. Our December 1st show will feature my friend Scott Terry discussing Christian presuppositional apologetics. Don't miss that one. And then after the holidays on January 5th, a special intellectual will be on the show discussing the facts and myths around National Socialism and the Third Reich. That's also one you don't want to miss. Several more guests are currently being booked, and I'll bring you more details in future broadcasts. But on the lawn right now is our returning guest. Robert Fingelfin is from North Texas, and he appeared here 3 months ago discussing the evils of law enforcement. Very popular show, and he's back tonight to continue and advance that theme. Please do listen to that downloadable interview at tribaltheocrat.com. And I welcome my friend, a comrade in the faith, and a keen cultural critic, Robert Fingelfin. Thanks for joining us tonight.
I'm glad to be back, Christian.
Good to have you.
I wanted to say, Yngwie Malmsteen will not be allowed to posit any questions. We'll only take questions from Paul Gilbert fanboys.
I agree. Yngwie is quite a jerk.
That was a great opening music there, Viking Kong from Paul Gilbert. I'm so glad you turned me on to that great piece of guitar music.
I think he does Yngwie stuff better than Yngwie.
Yeah, of course, yeah. We'll say that law enforcement is kind of the Yngwie Malmsteen, the neoclassical people that are talentless, and that folks like us are the Paul Gilberts looking to shoot them down. So, yeah, just musically, of course.
Yeah, he's got a weapon on him when he's holding that guitar, for sure. Before we continue, are the audio levels okay on your end, Robert?
That sounds good to me.
Good. Well, let's talk about this theme of local cops, bad cops, the police state, and the church who supports it. You and I have talked about this pagan criminal justice system, and it's your view that this stems from a bad Christian anthropology. Would you like to expatiate on that?
With the rise in the late 1600s and the 1700s with pietism and Neoplatonism, a man who, under the Calvinistic mode of thought, was held in definitely a different view than what he is now. And now we have in our criminal justice system, of course, the prison system is considered, you know, the only penology you could ever have, and that was, it's been with us forever, but in a more modern scene, the Quakers called it the penitentiary, where you went to do penance. And leading into that, now we have the kind of the terror state, the law enforcement state, to terrorize man into being right and into acting right. The idea of doing something for virtue is almost non-existent now. It's pretty much just, well, if you do this, we'll arrest you and put you in prison. And that's kind of worked its way out into our welfare state problems as well. And that the virtue that had been required in days past to have, you know, Christian-run hospitals or ways to help people locally has been pretty much been abolished. And now we have, you know, the welfare state taking its end. So it's kind of a give and take. And the welfare state, in turn, you know, helps generate a new generations of criminals. And the welfare states, in the worst parts of it, like what we're seeing in New York City right now with Hurricane Sandy and these huge, massive public housing blocks, that the war on drugs has really waged there because there's so much drug use and drug selling that goes on, and this in turn is good business for the police at law enforcement at all levels, whether the DEA at the federal level, the state police at the state level, and then of course various local and county initiatives against it as well. But to me, you know, getting back to the Christian anthropology in specific, that the death of doctrine doesn't like to talk about this. You know, most, so many churches now, well, no doctrine but Christ, and we just teach what's in the Bible. Well, you know, what is the Bible say on the nature and doctrine of man, the teleology of man, what's his ontological status? These get real short shrift now. No one wants to talk about it. Of course, these views are controversial, and many pastors do what they can to try to avoid that controversy. So it's a real nasty situation that I don't see getting better anytime soon. We so much need a revival in the church, but right now pretty much the only people that are willing to talk about these topics are outside of the church, and it's probably going to take the downfall of the current system before we see any improvement on that line.
Very good points. Do you think that Christian law here should be flexible or absolute pertaining to these things?
Well, I have to give a quick quote from, or shout out to Captain Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek, The Next Generation, who in a tirade on one episode said, "There can be no justice in a world ruled by absolute law." I think, you know, in the Christian system, and I alluded to this or talked a bit about it last time back in August, but this is a little bit different take on it. So people who caught the first show, you know, don't tune off right now. But the Christian system is focused on justice, and the law is used to attain justice ultimately. But in the short term, the law is not a mean end to itself. In other words, I mean, if you had to steal a car to take someone to the hospital, you know, would you do that under a Christian system? Well, of course you would, because of the saving of the life takes precedence over the theft of the car. And now in the Jewish system, with the Talmudic law, that the law to Jews, and I'd say this applies probably as well to Muslims, but to Jews, the law is something to be venerated in and of itself and to be worshipped. American law system or law schools, I think it, in many ways it's correct to say that these are just yeshivas run by the state for a civil law, and where people, well, the young aspiring idealistic lawyer comes out saying, "Oh well, I have a lot of respect for the law and we've got to uphold the law." Well, you know, that becomes ultimately where justice is completely lost in this, that people who have, killed someone that needed to be killing, what violated the law, or you could think of numerous situations where people have been railroaded, breaking unjust laws. And this could ultimately feed into the, I'm trying to think, and maybe you can help me remember here, a fully informed jury concept, where jurors could strike down laws by giving a not guilty verdict. And of course judges hate this concept and will almost never instruct a jury on it. And I think if you did see jury nullification via the fully informed jury concept, that law enforcement would certainly hold back law enforcement a lot of its greater evil. The few cops I've ever had the chance to even bounce the concept off of, they don't like it. They like a very clearly defined black and white law. Ultimately, I think that instead of having, thousands and thousands of pages of the U.S. Code or, the Texas State Code or regulations for Dallas County or whatnot, really you could take the Old Testament code and mix that in with the Beatitudes and create a basically probably, a four-page document that the average person could memorize that would give him a concept of right and wrong. And it wouldn't say, okay, well, you can't play your music at this many decibels, but it would just basically, don't music's allowed to, you know, to bother your neighbor, or if it comes to painting your house a certain color, we don't need a color code to keep the Mexicans from painting their houses purple or pink, as they're prone to do. Just, you keep your house the color of the people around you, and all, you know, that would go back to, say, private property rights. The Jews really do not want this. I mean, for one thing, because they've always dominated law schools and the practice of law, and having a secrecy with law is something that's very much to their favor. And it's one reason I think that the Latin language is still very much pervasive in the law system, that it gives it kind of an esoteric feel, and the average man doesn't, you know, understand those terms. And you see this a lot in medicine as well. But, you know, ultimately I would say that, that if the church rediscovers God's law, which was, you know, Rushdoony's life's work, R.J. Rushdoony's life's work, that there will have to be, with that concept, and Rushdoony would very much agree with this, is a focus on justice and not on petty law. And kind of finishing up this question here, you know, we've seen the shift in law and, now, in police work, you know, policemen used to be referred to as peace officers or sheriff's deputies, peace officers. Now they are referred to as law enforcement officers, and they enforce, you know, every little pathetic detail of the law. Okay, oh, well, your inspection sticker is required. Well, you know, why do you even have to have inspection stickers? Oh, you weren't wearing your seatbelt. Where no longer do they hold the, do they enforce the peace, to keep the peace there, they now enforce the law. And it's, that's a huge distinction. And as well as between law worship and the pursuit of justice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, most people don't realize that cops are not legally obligated to protect you. They're only legally obligated to enforce public policy, whatever that happens to be. It's always in flux.
Wasn't there even a Supreme Court decision on that that said basically that very thing?
I believe so. But we have the idea that cops are here, to protect us, and God gave us cops, so that's that. You mentioned jury nullification. That's an interesting concept. I didn't even come across that until somewhat recently. But basically, you can have a guy on trial for selling weed, okay, to his buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And if the jurors know he's guilty of breaking that law, but really think that he shouldn't be punished because they are maybe libertarians or something, they can acquit him.
Mm-hmm.
That's excellent.
The back in the 1990s, and I believe they're still around, there was an outfit called the Fully Informed Jury Amendment Association, and they called themselves FIJA for short, and they were proposing basically an amendment to the U.S. Constitution for a fully informed juror. And I do not believe, I don't think it was taking a pro-14th Amendment stance on that, where it would specify the exact wording, but I think it was basically where particularly federal courts would have to have a uniform concept of a fully informed jury. But I think this would also tell the states as well, okay, well, you have to have some concept of it, but we're not going to spell it out explicitly. Of course, you know, the 14th Amendment's been with us a long time, and I don't really see under the current American system getting back to what we used to have, in terms of, a, you know, more of a strict delegation of powers between states and the federal government. And I really wouldn't be totally opposed to, you know, taking a hardcore 14th Amendment approach to FIJA to try to just placate, you know, to deal with the current crisis. And once the system crashes, going back to more of an anti-federalist position, but it's certainly something that I wish was very explicitly spelled out in the Bill of Rights. And, of course, it was a different time back then. And, a lot of things that have taken place in the 1900s would have never been thought of in the 1700s. So I'm not going to be too hard on anti-federalists for not having that in their system.
There are certainly some big problems with courts. Talk about some other ones. Are prosecutors out of control? Is the cost of defense too high?
Yeah, Paul Craig Roberts, you know, a paleoconservative who's known by many of us, he wrote a book called The Tyranny of Good Intentions that just dealt basically with prosecutorial misconduct. The Old Testament says that, you know, that every charge must be established with two or three witnesses. And presumably these are people of good character. You know, it wouldn't be much point in having a witness that was a, you know, Satanist and prone to lie. There is, you know, discussion and probably areas of disagreement amongst theonomists as to whether, you know, what kind of non-verbal evidence might constitute, you know, legitimate evidence. We've seen, though, far too often how people can be framed by rigging of evidence and how various crime labs, and particularly the FBI's crime lab, has been proven numerous times to deliver rigged lab reports to make the FBI and Department of Justice look good. This has also happened at more local levels, state and county level as well, too. So, you know, if a man's trying to take on a bad court case, and he's, say, it's a federal issue, so the Department of Justice, of course, has, you know, billions of dollars in its pool that goes to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they, in turn, are fed evidence from the FBI generally, although it could sometimes be the Drug Enforcement Agency or the ATF. But let's just say it's the FBI, you know, another organization with a $1 billion budget. And here's some man, how's he supposed to defend himself from that? I mean, you know, it would take, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, which the average man does not have. And, the fact that the judges are usually a collusion between the Department of Justice's prosecutors via the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, and the judge themselves. And here comes the defense, you know, trying to, you know, break through that. What can be even more difficult is the Jewish networking that goes on between prosecutors and judges. If you have a Jewish judge and a Jewish prosecutor, well, I mean, that judge is going to probably go out of its way to favor the prosecutor. To, you know, the tribesmen network very well amongst themselves. It's a nightmare situation, and even the old doctrine of double jeopardy, where you couldn't be tried for the same thing twice, is increasingly, you're seeing more and more examples of that being broken, where the lawyers, functioning like good Jews, are finding, you know, loopholes to get around this problem. But it's a terrible issue, though, and when a policeman arrests someone on some bogus charge, manufactured or not, or bad law or not, very frequently he is bankrupting that person, and of course he would say, well, you know, I'm not the one ultimately responsible. Well, yeah, but you got the ball rolling. And you see very much in the American criminal justice system a tendency to pass the buck, where no one wants to take responsibility. You know, the prison guard says, well, you know, I just work here, or the prosecutor, well, I was just prosecuting the case that was given before me. Where people who can be cogs in a machine are every bit as much of a monster as they are, say, in a dictatorship.
You mentioned theonomy, which is interesting. It's the view that God's law, not man's law, should rule society, that all the Old Testament laws carry over to the New Testament unless rescinded or modified in the New Testament. It's plainly taught in Scripture, yet we have the Christian church today that embraces this system of courts and law enforcement that you're talking about. What's the primary reason that Christians have given up on God's law and embraced this Americanism?
You know, it's kind of there's so many factors that play into that. There's some people that have claimed, you know, I think Gary Norris one of them, that the American war for independence and the evolving American movement, the ditching of the Articles of Confederation and replacing with the Constitution were kind of the right-wing counterpart to the French Revolution. And of course the French have never recovered from the French Revolution, and it occupies kind of a mythical status amongst them. And I think you see the same thing in America too. And when the U.S. was founded, I mean, it was, you know, very much a new thing in the world of this idea of delegation of powers and getting away from the monarchy. It was, you know, it was an interesting, you know, I think Europe, and particularly the people of the UK, stood and looked at it and said, well, how's this going to go? I think the term drinking too much of your own bathwater ultimately applies here, though, that the people themselves ultimately started worshiping this American system. And state worship, of course, is, it's hardly a new concept, that the worship of Molech in the Old Testament, many consider Rushdie, one of them, was a kind of a worship, an exaltation of the state. You saw it again in the Roman Empire, the worship of the emperor. So it's hardly a new concept. But I think it's now you have the deification of democracy and the legislative process. I know when you and I talked fairly recently, we were just talking about how voting is almost assumed the status of a sacred sacrament. And it doesn't matter who you vote for, just as long as you vote. And if you don't vote, well, then, you're accursed because you rejected the American sacrament. But ultimately, beyond an idolatry issue, I think it comes back into the problems you start seeing in the Christian church in the late 1600s and the 1700s again, of the rejection of God's law, the embracing of Neoplatonism, the embracing of pietism, then the Enlightenment doctrine of neutrality. There is a writer, I quoted him last time, I believe, on the show, but his idea was that by the mid-1700s, the church had pretty much successfully divorced any concept of Christian doctrine of the state and government away from Christianity. And, of course, the Enlightenment thinkers, the ones that were more crafty, were always willing to say, well, you can be Christians, you can have your church and whatever, but, we have all these areas of thought that are just to be decided by pure reason. And, of course, ultimately they wanted to get ethics under their control, because once they had that, they had everything else. And if you had some superstitious people that still went to church and prayed and took communion, no big deal. And unfortunately, the Protestant church, as well as the Catholic church, surprisingly fell sway to that kind of thinking. And I'm still not entirely sure why. I mean, there are aspects of what the scholastics did back in the 13th century with Thomas Aquinas that helped give rise to that myth of neutrality. But, I think Aquinas would have ultimately stood in horror of a lot of what was accomplished then. Now that we're to the point, though, of, the concept of Noahides, which was discussed, I believe it was on a Mickey Bolwerk show, interview that you did with him here fairly recently, of these kind of junior Jews or Gentiles who swear to be good Jews or good Jew followers, that now you have a church that is so addicted on the Jewish issue, of they're so compromised there, that how can they realistically see who Satan is if they worship Satan's people? And I think that's one reason why they really hate God's law. Joe Moorcraft, about 20 years ago, a Presbyterian pastor down in Georgia, was saying that when one pastor was asked, well, if not God's law, then what? And the man responded, well, the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi. And it's just the antagonism and hatred of God's law that you see amongst Christians. It's just enormous. And I'm wondering more and more if we haven't crossed a pivotal line sometime, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, with the increased philo-Semitism, and now with just this kind of bogus, nebulous spirituality, that if the church isn't more of a Jewish organization now than it is a Christian organization. And certainly you see that with the charismatics and their love of not only Israel, but kind of a demonic doctrine of everything. And they, of course, would be the last ones to accept God's law because they want, their own special revelation given to them. Of course, they don't tell you how to resolve when two people say the Holy Ghost told them to do something that contradicts the other, they don't really have a lot to say on
right.
that.
No, sorry to cut in. Yeah, you're right. That's a good point. You mentioned
kind of getting off the track there, but I mean, it is important to the topic at hand.
Yeah, it is. You mentioned voting, and Robert, you've got to vote for Romney, man. We have to get Obama out. How many times have you heard that?
It's so depressing that people have decided that the sum of all evil in the country is it's fallen on one man, on Obama. And I mean, we certainly hate him, but to propose these messianic qualities to Romney and and you think everything that's bad in the country is due to Obama. You think it goes kind of back to what I was just saying of where people that love Satan's people, they can't really tell who Satan is anymore. And so they hate Obama, but then they want this new white devil who could be ultimately much worse than Obama to take over. It's so depressing to see it play out.
It really is. Unfortunately, some of my family members are really on my case lately about my non-voting position, and it's something I don't know what to do about because they're locked into a certain network of presuppositions that it doesn't allow for good debate and good dialogue. But they keep telling me, for example, that Mitt Romney's pro-life. I'm thinking, how can this guy be pro-life if he favors droning innocent civilians in Libya, for example? But anyhow, I won't get too far off the path, but that's a topic for a different show. So what do we
do? But it does raise the question, though. I mean, if people can't see the evil of Romney, how are they going to see the evil of law enforcement? And I mean, you and I look at a lot of the same websites on the evil of the cops. I mean, those sites are easy to find with all these different testimonies, and I think it's important people know about those things. And on Romney, I mean, you can type in, you know, how Romney is like Obama, and you'll get, you know, multiple responses. Like, here's a list of 40 ways. Here's a list of 100 ways.
Yep.
And we could, you know, on cop, the evil of police, we could have a 10-hour show where all you and I did was just trade stories that we'd sing about, oh, well, the cops are doing this. Oh, look what the cops are doing here. And, you know, it was the Apostle Paul. It was just talking about the unbeliever that they suppress that truth and unrighteousness. But you see now believers, or at least professing believers, that are suppressing the truth and unrighteousness about the police. Like, oh, no, I don't believe that. They're really not all that bad.
Yeah, it makes you sick. It really does. One more thing about Mitt Romney. Even from a basic evangelical approach, where does God require me to vote for a polytheist, non-Trinitarian guy who trusts his eternal salvation to Joseph Smith, who was a convicted peep stoner, for crying out loud? It's ridiculous. But they take this incremental approach. So if there's one sack of crap up there and there's one other half sack of crap, then we're supposed to vote for the half sack of crap.
It's like 10 steps backwards and 2 steps forward.
Yeah. So talking about,
of course, Mormons love being in government.
I mean,
they are just the CIA and the FBI are just riddled with Mormons, in large part, in the CIA especially due to their language skills, but also in the more local scene. I mean, Mormons love being cops, and you have this whole I think it was a prophecy by Joseph Smith, you know, using scare marks around a prophecy that at some point the United States would be dangling by a thread. And the Mormons would come in and would save it. And I think that, you know, as with law enforcement, we've had this longstanding threat with masonry. Pretty much throughout the U.S., the masonry and law enforcement have been very much synchronized with one another. And I don't know if Romney is elected, if you'll see I know you're going to see an upsurge in Mormonism throughout the country, but probably an increase in Mormonism within police ranks as well, too. I mean, after all, if it's good enough to have a Mormon in the White House, why can't you have one in a patrol car?
Yep.
And this is going to have more poisonous implications in law enforcement that, you know, the Masons have been able to network with each other that wear the badge, and now you're going to have the Mormons that network with one another.
Right.
And, yeah, it's a bad situation.
It really
so
is.
So many things are now.
You mentioned the article out there. I'll just give it to my listeners. It's called 40 Points That Prove That Barack Obama and Mitt Romney Are Essentially the Same Candidate. So just search for 40 Points Michael Snyder, and you'll see 40 reasons why these guys, on all the key big issues, are really the same guy. But we won't waste any more time on those two worthless fascists. Let's talk about what is a solution from a Christian perspective. How do we fully rebuke the police state?
Yeah, I think you have to start off with the theology again, because you really can't go anywhere long term unless you have that theology in place. But working that out, I mean, to the practical ends, and I think sometimes Reformed people are a bit guilty of thinking that they can change the world by reading books all the time and discussing theology, that I would say that probably going with concealed carry is one of the big things that people can do to help change the way things are, particularly in states that allow that. If you have a crime that goes down and you're not able to stop it because you're not carrying a weapon, well, you've kind of accepted a level of slavery to the state, even though you may not say you're a slave or think you're a slave. Nevertheless, you are depending on someone else to protect you. The more times that concealed carry holders stop crimes, the more the drive for kind of a fourth generation warfare approach, non-state approach to fighting crime will come into play, and I think will be more sympathetic. Then you add on to that places like Oklahoma just this past week approved open carry. And I think that's even better. I know some people call open carry shoot me first, doctrine. And these are not people who are anti-gun, just that they think that, concealed carry is the only way you should go to keep the criminals guessing. I don't agree with that myself. To me, that open carry is a sign of force, and it's very much a sign of competition to law enforcement. And it helps introduce the idea of what was commonplace up to probably, the 1880s and maybe even the 1890s in some places, of the armed man being in public. And this is a part of kind of taking back the concept of police powers back to individual people. And I think it's important too. I mean, I don't want to get too much into the nuts and bolts of that, but I think people should carry pepper spray or something like that as well to have a less lethal option. So if you're dealing, say, with like a drunk who's just a belligerent drunk, well, you don't want to kill the man, but maybe he's a 300-pound gorilla and deadly force would be unthinkable. To me, those are two of the really major things. But in a lot of our political corruption and just the police corruption itself is going to have to be dealt with going beyond concealed carry or open carry to where we start forming our own private non-state militias. And the church would be a great place to start this, where you'd have people that hopefully are on the same page with the view of law, and where you could kind of build each other up, train together, respond to other calls together. And I think ultimately this is one way of getting some respect back for the church, which of course the world has no respect for at this point. We're considered these spineless sissies, and rightly so. And if you were to see, I think, the rising of church militias, this would get a lot of respect back. And long term, if you could start seeing, I think, say 10% of men that were either in open carry or concealed carry, I think 10% to me is kind of a critical mass point that once that's met, I think it would start becoming real possible to try to make good arguments against rolling back the police. It's kind of odd to me that, as the police as they've gotten more and more depraved, is that they'll tell you like, oh, put locks on your doors or, oh, get an alarm system. They're all for all this passive defense, but, oh, don't buy a gun. That's active defense. But it's, odd in that with fire departments, they aren't going to say, oh, for God's sakes, whatever you do, don't buy a fire extinguisher and have it in your house.
Great point.
Yeah. And it's kind of odd how a lot of these things have worked out. I think ultimately the guy with the fire extinguisher is not so much the threat to the state mm-hmm. as the man with the gun is, although there is showing some responsibility by owning the fire extinguisher or having the hose to fight the fire. But kind of getting back to my original point, though, that ultimately we are going to have to form not so much gangs, but militias of our own. And once that's done, I think we can start rolling back police powers. I mean, I hope one of the first things we could do would be to greatly diminish the patrol officer concept, that you don't see firemen out driving around in their fire truck saying, oh, we're looking for fires.
Yes, right.
or we're preventing fires from starting. Yeah. They only respond to a fire that's actually happening. And if you could just roll back the police to a purely reactionary unit that where they only responded to crimes or investigated crimes that had happened. I mean, already that would be an enormous cut in their budget and the amount of people, the tax burden that they represent, as well as the people that are on patrol. I think, too, having armed men that are visible, it puts the police on notice that they are no longer the only game in town. And I think it would go a long ways to introducing a good deal of civility into their ranks, particularly if, you know, the armed man defends the weak. Well, if we see a bunch of cops wailing away on some innocent person, I think you'd sent me a link earlier in the week to a kid, I believe it was in New Mexico, that a cop said, "Do you want to wash my car?" And he said, "Well, no." And then the cop tasered him. And before he tasered him, said, "Well, I'm going to show you what happens to people that don't, you know, obey police orders."
Yeah.
Well, I mean, imagine what happens if an armed man's there and sees that. I mean, the cop might end up eating a couple of bullets, or at the very least, just having the, you know, holy living hell beat out of him.
Then the cop had the audacity to say that he didn't even know it was loaded.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, now you're into issues of gross incompetence.
Yeah.
Which you see repeatedly, and particularly amongst black cops. I mean, kind of a shaved ape that they can't even operate a Glock firearm. There was an instance here in Dallas of a cop who shot himself in the leg with his Glock. And I mean, for those who are familiar with the Glock firearm, you know, how do you do that?
Right.
You know, how do you have an accidental discharge? And you find so many accidental discharges that take place with law enforcement, and a lot of them are not that bright. And I don't know if they start once again drinking too much of their own bathwater and assume that, you know, they can yell and scream at the gun and it'll do what, you know, they want to do. But, you know, I'm sorry, but it's, you know, it's a mechanical mechanism that obeys that and the laws of chemistry. And if you pull the trigger, it's, you know, it's going to happen. But with the instance, like you're saying, where the man didn't even know his taser was loaded, well, okay, well, that brings up a whole other issue of law enforcement incompetence.
Yeah, what's he doing carrying around an unloaded taser? What good is that?
Sure. it's a simple yes or no question. Is it, you know, is it, can it be used or can it not? And if you can't answer that question, well, then, you know, we need to find another line of work for you.
And even if it weren't loaded and he knew it wasn't loaded, it's the basic rule in firearms to never always treat a gun as if it's loaded and beware of your backstop and don't put your finger on the trigger, et cetera, et cetera. He violated all those rules.
Every one of them. Yeah, I mean, he should have been fired today. And, I mean, as it is, he's probably enjoying a 3-week paid vacation.
Sure he is.
Courtesy of the Albuquerque PD.
Ah, boy, my blood boils over these stories. As you know, you and I have exchanged several of them over the last 3 months, and it makes you go crazy. You mentioned a few minutes ago that the Christian can't see Satan all around him. What is the reason for that? Do we have a different allegiance? Is there a different standard? Why can't we see this?
Yeah, you know, when I think a systematic theology was abandoned by the church, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it led to a great deal of contradictions in theology, of cherry-picking verses for arguments where people could say, well, the verse in Genesis about he who blesses my people, I will bless them. Well, because of systematic theology has been rejected, so is hermeneutics. So that was, you know, talking about the Hebrews that occupied the land of Israel long, long ago prior to Christ. And because of the rejection of systematic theology and hermeneutics, these distinctions cannot be made anymore. And because of that, we've got a lot of insanity that has popped up into Christian theology. The charismaniacs being, you know, probably the ones that are leading the way on that. But you've seen a lot of the same problems in the Reformed tradition. And I think once you start seeing that level of contradiction in your base theology, that it starts working its way out in your metaphysics as well. There's been, and justifiably so, a lot of good Christian response to the doctrine of evolution, because evolution is a great evil. But then a lot of people will turn around and unquestionably embrace all aspects of quantum mechanics, where you'll get this in this perverse Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, ideas that, well, two particles can occupy the same space. Well, you know, that's taking the Christian doctrine of philosophical area of metaphysics and turning it up, you know, on its head. You're saying that the nature of reality is fundamentally perverse. You know, why not have two people occupy the same space? What make good equal evil? So you get into this, you know, kind of satanic dualism. If you believe that two particles can occupy the same space, why not have good equal evil? God is Satan, or Satan is God, or man is God. Jews are God. Satan's people are God. But it's scary, though, that now that they have pretty much have lost all ability to reason and to take data and interpret it correctly. Unfortunately, you know, you and I are both presuppositionalists, so we really don't believe in raw, uninterpreted data. I think, though, with a lot of Protestantism, there has been a practical or functional redefining of the Trinity, that you still have God the Father and God the Son, but God the Holy Spirit has been replaced, I think, in many instances, with God the Bible. And this view that, well, you don't need wisdom, you know, of course, what you get from the Holy Spirit, ultimately by praying for it, but you don't need wisdom to interpret the Bible. If the Bible is raw and uninterpreted, you know, just it's data there that, you know, that can be interpreted correctly by anyone, and it's not needing wisdom to see that. And ultimately, I think a lot of, probably a lot of the more perverse TBN element in particular would probably say that unbelievers or Satanists could read the Bible and come to the same, come to the correct conclusion about things, and they can't. Ultimately, long term, I don't know where this is going. I mean, the Romney problem, we have the law enforcement problem, the issue with the Jew problem in the church, it's pretty horrifying. We know the nature of where the Catholic Church stood in around 1500, and you know what Luther did to it. It's probably going to take a Reformation on that size again. That's going to deal with a lot of these fundamental epistemological questions that are errors that have just crept into Christian theology.
Talk a little bit about Pietism, how the Church has crept into this horrible paralyzation of Pietism.
Yeah, I think that if you embrace Neoplatonism, and for those who don't know what Neoplatonism is, the Greek philosopher Plato, you know, he held that there was a world of matter and a world of ideas. And that was kind of his nature, and you view the nature of reality. And he held that the world of ideas was superior. And for those of you wondering about how does this tie into cops, well, it ties in a huge way, but I'll got to get lay the groundwork first. We say Neoplatonism because this is in essence a new Platonism. It's not the old Greek Hellenistic Platonism. This is kind of a Christian view of Platonism. With the Christian view, you say that the spirit world is superior to the material world. That, you know, God didn't create man good. He didn't create the earth good and see it corrupted by sin. No, he pretty much has turned the keys over to Satan, and Satan runs everything now. So you hear the, you know, the little cliches, we are not of this world, and you get these Christians are really no earthly good because they're so otherworldly minded. As a matter of fact, I had one preacher who trained under Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones in the UK tell me that he said that the physical world is not the real world, that the spirit world is the real world. And I mean, you know, that's about as big of a confession of being a Neoplatonist as you can get. You know, how that ultimately ties into the world of law enforcement and the problem with that is that a man who believes that the material world is not the real world, that the spirit world is the real world, that he offers no threat to satanic power structures whatsoever. I mean, how could he? Because he is focused on his inward self, and the spirit world, the world of ideas, that you have this inward perverse turning and introspection and looking into oneself. And this plays its way out in church, you know, Sunday after Sunday, of where you have nebulous sermons about, well, let's stay focused on the gospel and focused on Christ. Hey, I mean, you know, Calvinism is a little bit, you know, complex compared to Arminianism, but I don't think I need to stay focused on the Calvinistic gospel Sunday after Sunday for two decades straight. You know, we can buy Lorraine Bettner's The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination and read it in, you know, in the space of probably 20 hours time or so. And that's why, you know, Calvinism ultimately, which does affirm the the natural world and the goodness of it is a great threat ultimately to tyrants, and whereas Arminianism isn't. The Arminianism, because it tends to focus on a works-based salvation to varying degrees, I mean, now it's a very much a lawless view on that, but still it tends to be focused on kind of a mystical focus on the person itself and pietism. So when you start mentioning these real physical problems in the world with, you know, whether it be cops or public schooling or Obama or Romney or whatever, oh, we don't need to be focused on that. We need to be focused on the Bible or the gospel or ridding ourselves of sin. Of course, the people that say that, that the 20th century, the prosperity of America has allowed a lot of heresies to rise up because if people have full stomachs, if their roof isn't leaking, if no one's trying to kill them, well, most people are pretty complacent. Well, I mean, aside from North Texas, where, you know, if the Cowboys are having a losing season, it's treated as, you know, as the freaking apocalypse. And we're in another apocalyptic season here. But, you know, generally speaking, if people have those things, they're not interested in these other problems. The sad fact of human nature is that people are not abstract thinkers. The majority of them are not abstract thinkers. And even your Christians, where we're more prone to be abstract thinkers, they have been brought up on this, you know, bankrupt church which embraces pietism and Neoplatonism. And, you know, abstract thinking, it's hard. It's difficult. They just rather go to an Awana Club meeting or learn how Jesus loves, you know, them. Or now you're seeing the rise of universalism springing its ugly head, and Jesus loves everyone. So, you know, you don't even have to go through the gritty work of evangelism anymore, and particularly not with the Jews, because God loves them for other reasons. And if you believe in universalism, well, how can the cops be bad? How can the government be bad? God loves everything. God's in control of everything. A perverse view of the sovereignty of God coupled with Arminianism, and this gets back to the question a while ago about how can the lack of discernment amongst Christians. So, you know, how do you have this contradictory teaching that God is in control of everything, yet he's not in control of the individual souls of men, but God creates hell, but actually we don't believe that anymore because of universalism. It's a whole wicked mishmash that needs to be torn down.
Our guest tonight is Robert Finkelfen. If you have a question for him, jump in the chat room. We'll try to get to those at the top of the hour. We'll probably run about 15 minutes after the hour, and perhaps we can have you back then on a future show. Robert, what do you think?
No, I think so. I mean, I'm looking at my list right now, and we've barely even scratched the surface.
We have so much to talk about. So if you have a question, please give that to me. So why won't pastors talk about these issues, Christian anthropology, talk about teleology? What's going on here?
Well, somehow I think I have a theory that with the close of the Indian Wars in the 1880s, that men became increasingly pacified by civilization, and the public schools went a long ways to doing that. I have fundamental problems with the pastoral model anyway. I think the idea of having one man up Sunday after Sunday who really doesn't have any equal peers to turn to except through maybe local ministerial alliances, I think is a bad idea. But yet you do see amongst, like, say, the Puritans, who had lots of problems, but yet, you know, Puritan pastors, they weren't afraid to make their congregants angry, you know, that they told how the cow ate the cabbage very frequently. But somehow after the close of the 19th century, these kinds of men started to disappear, and it wasn't just in the pastorate, but it was also in the ranks of the military and the business world, too, that careerism started raising its ugly head, where people were just focused on getting ahead above all truth, as well as materialism, where people were just seeking material gain. The pastor, in a lot of ways, though, he's given an occupational license. It's not a state license, but it's usually one issued by a denomination or some sort of seminary structure. And so he alone is considered to have, you know, the gates to the kingdom. You know, if we were Catholics, that would be kind of how they would look at it. But they have found that, you know, by preaching on mediocre subjects of you know, salvation week in and week out, or small little biblical concepts, that the average congregant will say, wow, this is wonderful, this is great. And they basically preach things that even Satan himself would probably say, well, you know, I don't really have a problem with that. But it's good for stability. It's good for being at the same place for a long time. And for, like, you know, large denominations like the United Methodists, who move their clergy around a lot, the thing they want is to go in, be good for a place for 3 years, and then get promoted to a larger church and a larger paycheck. And overall, I would say our civilization has a bad problem with truth seeking, and it does not really seek after the truth anymore. And the professional class, the bourgeoisie, is just, it is so compromised in this area of, you know, lawyers who are basically, you know, rabbis, medical doctors who have basically embraced kind of a form of witchcraft called allopathic medicine, which really isn't at all focused on healing people. The pastoral class with its issues, the judges with their problems, and we could go on and on. But to me, ultimately, I think what's going to have to fix the problem with the pastors is, once again, probably a destruction and tearing down of the American system and the American church system, and probably the embracement of some sort of plural elder system where you see tent maker clergy who hold jobs during the week, maybe who swap the duties with one another, but where having some sort of financial independence via another job will at least restore some amount of courage to take on these issues. And I think, plus two, you're going to have to see a change in the American layman, who is willing, not just willing, but hungry to hear topics like we're talking about tonight discussed. And right now, you know, about the only time they want to deviate from their pietism is to hear that voting for Romney will make all the problems go away.
So regarding the single pastor point, I tend to agree with that. What you're essentially saying is that the quality of service, quality of preaching, for example, goes down when there's no competition.
Exactly. And I think, you know, you can see that with the police as well, or any profession that has excessive constraints placed on it, the practice of it. You know, medicine, healthcare is expensive in this country because doctors enjoy a huge amount of occupational protection via the monopoly or pseudo-monopoly that the state bestows upon them with their occupational license. With cops, the license isn't so hard to get. I mean, you have to go through usually some sort of training academy that's 8 to 12 weeks long. The problem is keeping that license, that, you know, you're not allowed to say, well, I'm going to go through cop school, and then I just want to be a auxiliary cop or reserve sheriff's deputy. No, I mean, if you're going to keep those police powers, you pretty much have to work as a full-time law enforcement officer. With the clergy, they've said that, you think of degree inflation, of where people now, like lawyers, well, they say, well, I have a doctorate degree, because they have, you know, the law degree is a Juris Doctorate. But you look at it, and you can get a bachelor's degree in any kind of field you want, you know, basket weaving, engineering, chemistry, whatever, and then you get this Juris Doctorate that's just basically an undergraduate degree that's tacked onto that to make it where poor people can't become lawyers. Well, that's degree creep. And you see, you know, I think, you know, a medical doctorate, that realistically, that's at best a master's degree. Well, the clergy started out with the degree creep, with the Master of Divinity degree, and then later on with the THM. Those, you know, once again, you can study anything you want for as an undergraduate degree. And then you go off for 3 years and you study this field, usually, you know, about 90 hours worth for the degree. Well, you know, I spent 90 hours of core engineering courses for my undergraduate degree. But now, so it's already a hard field to get into. Most people can't sacrifice 3 years of their life to be a part-time clergyman. And yet we've seen, you yourself were talking about when you used to do a lot of mowing, how you would just load up, you know, your iPod and just, you know, listen to hours and hours and hours of lectures. There's more than one way to get an education. Look at like James Nichols, who wrote the book of Mathematics is God Silent. I mean, a fantastic Vantillian presuppositional approach to mathematics. I mean, it's a PhD worthy study, but would he be ordained by any presbytery in the country? I don't think so. They would say, well, no, you don't have an MDiv. We can't ordain you.
For the record, that was a Microsoft Zune, not an iPod. I don't like Apple products.
Well, yeah, there's that whole cult of Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I know. Just
people belonging to. But, you know, just the church does not, the church was the first to embrace the tyranny of academic, you know, certification. And you saw that, Gary North's book, Crossed Fingers, that deals with how the Northern Presbyterian Church fell into apostasy, of where the Princeton Seminary was insistent that its clerk, that the professors there had PhDs. And they got into the kick of wanting to send them over to Germany to study under these higher criticism, or these devotees of higher criticism, and many of them lost their faith. You know, J. Gresham Machen, who started the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, you know, he went through a time of where, you know, he said that he nearly lost his faith. And then he, you know, wrote, kind of came to his senses and wrote Liberalism and Christianity, which was a debunking, I think, of the higher criticism movement, showing how, you know, the heterodoxy that it preaches is not Orthodox Christianity at all. But, you know, I think that is one of the major issues with the clergy, is that they have embraced this ultimately fraudulent, dishonest degree, a master's degree, which is not in an occupational licensing. Well, they've embraced occupational licensing, and it spread like poison through a lot of other American professions. And I think if the church wants to get really serious about doing battle with the state, it's going to have to start rewarding and looking for men of competence, not men who have degrees, because certainly the degreed man has not shown to be a competent man in many instances.
Couple quick questions for you from the chat room. J.F. Berry wants to know, and I've wanted to know this too, what are your thoughts on recent reports of several federal departments purchasing large quantities of hollow point ammunition? We've heard about the Homeland Security Department, the National Weather Service, for crying out loud, and even the Social Security
yep.
Administration have purchased large quantities of ammo. What's going on here?
Well, if, you know, if I worked for the National Rifle Association, I would say those were all legitimate service, all legitimate purchases to help them fulfill their law enforcement function. And indeed, that's what the NRA has said. Then the simplest answer to me is, I think it's pretty obvious. They're gearing up for war with the civilian populace of the U.S., particularly the Department of Homeland Security, where they've purchased, you know, millions and millions of rounds of 40 caliber ammunition. It is kind of interesting, though, you know, things like the National Weather Service. I think they bought like 175,000 rounds. And, you know, what on earth are they doing with that kind of ammunition? But there's just more of the antagonism of the state towards the people that support it. Right now, and it depends on whose statistics you believe or the methodology employed, but either 1 out of 4 or 1 out of 5 people are employed by some branch of government, federal, state, local. So, you know, if you say even 1 out of 5 people, that means 4 out of 5 people who are employed have to support that other person. Well, that means that, you know, a 25% tax rate just on salary alone. It was sometime, I think, during the early Bush years that it started to become apparent that the federal employee was the new middle class, and that federal salary pay increases started vastly outstripping those of the private sector. And I think the sense of entitlement by federal workers, that's what finding its way over to their law enforcement department too. The heathen, at some level, many Reformed people believe, and I do too, that they know at some level that God hates them, and that the world around them hates them, and this leads to kind of a degree of paranoia. You know, ultimately it said that when Christ returns, of course, many thousand years from now, due to our post-millennial view of things, that the unbeliever will go beneath the mountain when Christ returns bodily and pray for the mountains to fall on him. Well, I think this paranoia that you're seeing with law enforcement starts expressing itself in many ways, the trigger happiness, the desire to control every situation. He can't stand on the sovereignty of God. He believes in the sovereignty of the badge. And as a result of the paranoia, they start inventing and creating threats that don't exist. I mean, sometimes this will even be expressed in bogus intelligence reports that you'll see via the fusion centers that were started by the Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice under Bush, where they'll, you know, usually very frequently the Anti-Defamation League or World Jewish Congress will come in and say, hey, we got some great intelligence for you. Let's give it to you. But where they're very hostile, the people that vote for Ron Paul or who consider themselves constitutionalist or any way believe the government is abusive. And so this all goes into, I believe, these enormous ammunition purchases where they cannot see that they themselves, particularly that's hammer on the Department of Homeland Security, that they are the real threat to America, but due to their perverse and bent nature, that they see the American people as the enemy, or the patriots as the potential enemy, or the paleoconservatives. And so they've made these huge ammo purchases with the idea of that, you know, probably that there's a war coming and that they're, you're going to wage war against us.
Yeah. And all you stupid Christians who voted for George Bush, you guys can thank him for the Department of Homeland Security, and especially as it is being overseeing the TSA and all their genital fondling and nude picture taking and the harmful radiation coming from these x-rays. Thanks a lot for voting for that jerk.
Great question. Oh, one last thing in closing off on that question was that Dan Smoot, a very famous old right commentator from the 50s and 60s, wrote a book called The Business End of Government. Was basically about, you know, the regulatory state and how it really impacts people in their daily lives. And to me, the TSA is, to me, you know, probably the finest example of the business end of government, of how it, you know, just brute force right in your face, and how it, so many people have been mistreated by it. And if we have time to get to the question, or maybe we should just handle it now, but kind of the Stockholm syndrome that impacts a lot of people where they end up ultimately loving and worshiping their tormentors. But you said there was another question online, so let's deal with that one first.
Yeah, this comes from some fellow named Mickey Henry. He wants to know what you think about the change in appearance of police over the past 30 years, for example, shaved heads, combat boots, and other militaristic clothing.
Yeah, the old peace officer, you know, he had his Sam Brown belt on and his bus driver hat and probably wore a tie, you know, long sleeves and wore, you know, shiny dress shoes. And now, of course, you know, they're wearing some sort of battle dress uniform and, always have the sunglasses so you can't see their face and, the shaved heads and whatnot. I think part of it is it's obviously the militarization of the police, but as to why it goes on, I think a lot, you have the pagan mentality amongst law enforcement, and they have the desire to make themselves look different, as pagans frequently do. You think of the body modification that you see going on now. It's just become, you know, ubiquitous, I'm sad to say, where people will put studs in, you know, in their ears, their nose, you know, body modification, tattoos, all sorts of horrible things. And so the cop says, well, I can set myself apart from the civilian by, you know, shaving my head. Now, they may say, if you really push them on this, well, that way a criminal can't grab my hair and, you know, use that as a means against me in a fight. Well, you know, cops up into the 1980s pretty much wore, you know, had hair normal person length. And yet somehow or the other, it didn't manage to get, you know, that hair didn't get many of them killed, if any at all. As a matter of fact, when I was in the Air Force in the 80s, it was highly frowned upon to have buzz cuts or very short hair, that we were told to look like respectable civilians. But you've always had military units, particularly the Rangers and the Marine Corps infantry units, that have had these, you know, the jarhead haircut. The Rangers have a similar haircut, to set themselves apart, but it's a kind of a perverse paganism. Then the rest of the cop uniform, the now, you know, mandatory sunglasses, This is obviously an intimidation technique. And once more, where they are no longer the servants of the people, but that where they aim to be the masters. And the rest of their outfit, you know, goes back down to just pretty much, you know, the militarization. A lot of them consider themselves to be parts of elite units that the, you know, some pathetic little town has a SWAT unit, but, you know, like, well, where's elite as Delta Force? And I know it sounds strange, but if you read these gun magazines where they'll have cops writing articles, I mean, they really believe this stuff about themselves, that they're, you know, these elite units that stand between us and death. And, I think that the doctrine known as the thin blue line, it's been in existence, ever since we started seeing an enormous upcreep in police, where the thin blue line furnished by police is all that stands between us and anarchy. Like, well, you know, forget the Holy Spirit, forget the redeemed man, you know, holding back the nature of evil, the evil in people. Now the people that have bought into this, I think it's working out in very perverse ways of where they want to be seen as our overlord to keep us from killing each other or whatever evil it is we're supposed to do. That's one of the fundamental questions, too, of the police state. Of, you know, I'd rather deal with organized crime than the police state. The mafia is less a threat to me than the police state. Sure, people can be bad, but organized people are much worse. There's a professor at the University of Hawaii named R.J. Rummel, and he wrote a book called Death by Government. And he did a study over the 20th century, I think up to about 1990 or so. And he determined, I think it was like 175 million people had been killed by government during that time. Well, you know, how many people have organized crime or non-organized crime killed off? Well, I mean, they've done a lot of evil. But by far, by and large, I mean, the government wins the murder status hands down. And anytime you have a police state emerging, that's a problem you're going to have to deal with. So, yeah, going back to the original question, though, is just, I think the rise of paganism and the desire to establish themselves as our overlords.
I have one more question. And I have to skip the rest of them for the interest of time. But Carrie wants to know, and I've had the same question, if the dollar collapses and we do see some kind of economic disaster, a stock market crash or whatever, do you think the local police we have today are principled enough to abandon their jobs, or do you think they will join up in this martial law and fight us?
I think they will join up in the martial law. Your conservatives have a real nasty habit, and always have, of assuming that the police and military are on their side. But time and time and again, we've been shown that they weren't. When Texas passed mandatory seatbelt usage law, which I think was like 1991 or so, that all these conservatives are telling that, no, oh, these great cops, they're so conservative, they'll never, you know, enforce that rule. Well, now it seems like I'm the only person left who's never been given a ticket for seatbelt usage. Actually, I do wear my seatbelt all the time, but the point being is that it seems like everyone I know has been given a ticket for not having a seatbelt on. I think that the cops that have talked tough about not doing that, if they come to the realization that we have 30 or 35% unemployment, that you have food riots in progress, that if they quit their job, they're not going to get, you know, hired by someone else. And that maybe in the worst case scenario, if they quit their job, they may even do, you know, jail time. No, I don't see it happening at all. You know, I'm familiar with the Oath Keeper movement, and I'm somewhat appreciative of what they're trying to do, but to me, it's a fantasy. You can't have cops doing what they're doing now and living as unprincipled sons of hell, and then all of a sudden flip a switch and say, no, I'm going to be principled all of a sudden, and I'm going to give up my livelihood and lose my house. But, you know, that's a line that can't be crossed. I don't doubt that a few of them would cross over and say, well, no, I'm not going to do that. But the, you know, the point isn't about the 10% that cross over. It's what is 90% of the badge holders going to do. And increasingly, we've seen more and more that the police are turning more anti-gun. You can see this, there was an article you'd sent me, it was in a gun magazine where
oh, yeah.
The editor was saying, well, I'm glad people can't get access to this gun. And I've seen that kind of comment, you know, that's not the only time where policemen will ride and say, well, I don't know if I like the idea of people having AR-15s. That this is an attitude getting more perverse, more pervasive, excuse me.
Yeah, what was the name of that? What was the name of the magazine, by the way?
What was the name of the magazine?
Yeah, I think it was Recoil Magazine, and it was in regards to
to
an H&K submachine gun.
It was one of their newer models.
Yeah, the gun could penetrate police armor at 200 yards, and so the guy said, this is something that we want to keep out of the hands of scumbags, and he was referring to civilians.
Sure. Well, you know, of course, cops don't consider themselves civilians. They are, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure what they consider themselves. I mean, at least, you know, the military people that are active duty that, you know, they're sequestered away on bases or whatnot. You know, they have a little bit more reason to say they're not civilians, but a cop, you know, you work for a township and you live in a neighborhood with us, but, you know, we're civilians, and, you know, civilian's a dirty word to them.
Yeah.
It's a question really of how far they'd be willing to go. There was an article that made headway, I think, back in 1994, 95. Soldier of Fortune magazine was talking about it. A lieutenant colonel, I believe, in the Marine Corps had conducted a survey of Marines during a training exercise at 29 Palms in California, just asking, you know, what percentage would fire on Americans if there was firearms confiscation or food riots or, you know, some other disaster. And it was, you know, it was pretty scary figures that would say they would do that. And that was, you know, that was over 15 plus years ago.
Right.
And the public schools have done their foul work. And, you know, the fusion centers, which I mentioned earlier, you know, they've organized these clergy response teams, which last time I've checked, they had 26,000 clergymen responded. And their whole purpose is to come out and cry Romans 13, you know, if there's some draconian measure support.
Yeah.
And right now already you have the police chaplains are basically trying to give the hand, you know, the stamp of God onto, you know, all these evil, different laws that the police enforce. So I would suspect that there would be an attempt made if there was a riot due to hyperinflation or, the government said, well, you gotta collect the guns now, that the, clergy response teams and the police chaplains to say, well, that's what Jesus demands in Romans 13. You know, disobey it and you'll lose your soul. And then, you know, the man's facing, you know, probably, you know, completely biblically illiterate. And then on top of that, so, you know, realizes that, you know, he's never saved a dime because he knows that he would never lose his job. And, I think ultimately, you know, a lot of them will find ways to justify it.
People
are capable of convincing themselves of all kinds of crazy stuff.
Unfortunately.
But Romney's good.
Yeah, I hate to admit it, but I tend to agree. It's going to be a sad situation when it happens. It's about 13 past the hour. Do you have time for one question, or do you want to wrap it up?
So let's go for another question.
Okay, we'll just talk about what you and I have spoke about in the past, and you sent me an interesting chart about the differences between a dutiful patriot and a self-indulgent matrix. Can you elaborate on that for our listeners?
It was kind of a breakdown how our society has become increasingly a matriarchy in many ways. And this actually goes back to questions of, you know, the problem of the church and just looking at the how probably since the 1600s there's always been more women attending than there have been men. And there's been several books written trying to address this question. One, there's a pretty good book written by a Roman Catholic on the subject. And, you know, obviously we look now at the public schools. Those are entirely in the hands of women. That the church is very much a matriarchy. That the, you know, pastor pretty much operates to please the women in the congregation. Anyway, this was a writer, that kind of looked at the traits of a matriarchy, of a matriarchy versus a patriarchal society. And, you know, that the, by and large, I would say that the, you know, the patriarchal society was more, it was more of a society we'd want to live in. But where you saw that there was a need for balance between the two, and I think this was, you know, as God intended marriage, where there would be some complementation of each other. You know, one of the major points that I thought was kind of, it kind of showed you, though, where when each sex is left to itself, it can create its own degree of poison. In the chart, he has, like, say, the take on religion that the hyper-patriarchalist will say, the view of religion is just do as you're told. Whereas under the matriarchy, it's do as you feel. Well, both of those are very poisonous. But I think a problem that we've seen in particularly older denominations to harken back to the early days of the Reformation or the Catholic Church itself is that those were times that were more, that had more problems, along the lines of the hyper-patriarchy and, where they were very unquestioning on things that needed to be questioned. We've seen this, rise up in the Reformed world recently, say like R.C. Sproul Jr.'s church in, Bristol, Virginia, or going back into the 1980s, the just horrible abomination that was, Westminster Presbyterian Church in Tyler, Texas, that, you know, you, the elders told you to do something, well, do it. It's kind of ironic, though, that you had, you know, a movement that produced men like John Knox, or the book Vindiciae Contra Tyrannis, which was, you know, opposition to tyranny, that you have this one faction, though, that wants to maintain this kind of hyper-patriarchal view of do as you're told, and then yet sometimes they'll try to say, well, we have to be opposed to statism. Well, you know, how can you have the view in your church of doing as you're told, but then we're going to have some anti-statist doctrine? Generally, it hasn't worked out that way, that one or the other tends to emerge as the dominating philosophy. Either they'll see anti-statism as the virtue and they'll abandon their, you know, just overly dogmatic view of church authority, or that the church authority view will win out and they'll become like a lot of the Scottish Covenanters who are really, I mean, they're almost worthless in, when it comes to opposition to the state. And that ties back into the thing we've had going the entire last hour and 15 minutes of why is it, you know, Christians have so little discernment and offer so little opposition to the evil in our times. Because I think of a lot of the contradictory doctrines they have, you know, in their system of thought right now. I mean, they may reject systematic theology, but they still have a systematic theology. It's just a very bad one. You know, a few other points from the chart that I think are worth pointing out is that under the patriarchal system of politics, authority is strict and clear. Under the matriarchal one, there's no clear fixed authority. Under innovation, there's multiple ways to interpret the innovation that, let's take theological innovation, that a lot of the Scottish Covenanters would say, well, innovation is perilous. The matriarchy says innovation is fun. Well, we don't want to be innovators for innovation's sake. And then ultimately, then on inquiry, accept without question for the patriarchalist. Under the matriarchalist, it's question everything. Both sides are ultimately fundamentally poisonous and will undermine the society that they're in. I would say, though, now we have a system that's a matriarch. Our social structure is a matriarchy without any of the benefits of matriarchy. Along those lines, you know, Samuel Francis coined the term anarcho-tyranny. And that's what we have in the U.S., that you have an anarchy for the criminal class and tyranny by the government class. So versus, say, like, you know, anarcho-capitalism, with anarcho-tyranny, you have, you know, none of the advantages of a state, of a society void of government, but with all the disadvantages of a criminal class. I'm not sure if I said that right, but in essence, you know, where you have a totalitarian state trying to crush you and a lawless criminal class trying to crush you, if that puts it better. But it's a very interesting chart, I think, that offers a lot of insight into a topic that's not being discussed much today.
Would you mind if I posted that chart on tribaltheocrat.com, or is that something that...
Knock yourself out.
Yeah, oh, okay.
I think it's a JPEG format.
Yeah, it helps a lot if people could read it. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's just it's something people need to understand, I think, in terms of the complementary nature of the sexes as God created them, but how under egalitarianism, that everyone has, you know, risen up to say, well, I'm equal with everyone else. And so, you can see the poison of having a purely masculine system and a purely feminine system, and how if the, if you had a complementary system, it would have a way of ironing out some of those bad problems that are indigenous to each one.
Well, Robert, I want to thank you so much for joining me once again. We have a lot of material to cover, and I'll try to book something with you maybe late winter, early spring.
Sounds good. Yeah, we got most of we've got tons of stuff left we can talk about. So
yeah,
it was a good conversation, as always.
It was. I very much enjoyed it. And thank you for all the listeners who's tuned in tonight. Check us out November 17th, as we have on a special guest to talk about the evils of homeschooling. Thanks a lot. See you next time.